Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello, I'm Em, and today I'll be speaking with Bami. Throughout her life, Bami has been affected by breast cancer. She sadly lost her mum and sister to the disease and later developed it herself. Now she educates others on how to be breast aware. Bami, thank you for joining me.
Em, thanks for having me.
Lovely. I wonder, Bami, could we begin by speaking a little bit about your mum and your sister? Did they speak with you about their breast cancer experiences? Or were you aware of what they were going through at the time?
Okay, that's a very long story, actually. Mm-hmm. My late mom was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1990, so that's 31 years ago. Mm-hmm. And given the kind of environment I was in or whatever like that, the stigma, the shame, the suspicion, the fear, it wasn't spoken of for a long time. In fact, after my mom got ill and she went to hospital and she came back, by this time she'd had the mastectomy and the lymph nodes removed from her left side. So it was when she came back home and she was in the living room and told me to go and get her meds. So I now picked out one of the meds, which happened to be tamoxifen. Mm. And I pulled out the leaflet to read what it was. So that was when I found out that she had breast cancer. But then in the last year of her life, she told me at length about it and the journey. Mm. And then with my sister, because my sister was living here in the UK, as soon as she was diagnosed, she told me and everything like that. And the thing was, she went to a GP the year before, and a GP thought he had to do with her breastfeeding and that she was too young and everything. Mm. But unfortunately, at that particular point, the year before, she didn't tell us anything because a GP said there was nothing to worry about. And then 1 year fast forward, unfortunately, she had a very aggressive stage 3 breast cancer in both breasts. Mm. You know, so that thing about being told by her GP that she's too young and all of that stuff, it's one of those things that's, it's an issue, really. And it's something that I know it's better addressed now, because my sister was diagnosed in 2011. We're now in 2021. So 10 years have passed and things are getting better, but there's still a lot of work, more work that needs to be done.
Mm. Yeah, still very, very recent, last 10 years. But obviously, you mentioned your mum, that was over 30 years ago now. Did you notice a difference between when she was diagnosed and when your sister was diagnosed? Do you think your mum not speaking about her diagnosis might have caused your sister to be a bit more open about it?
Well, the issue is like our family situation at the time. My sister didn't grow up with us.
Oh, okay.
She was already in the UK. So I was the one who was looking after my mom, so I got to experience that firsthand. And because I got to experience that firsthand, because whenever my mom was out of hospital, I was a carer. So you can imagine from the age of 13 to the age of 17. Mm. And in Nigeria, there's no psychosocial support because, of course, everything is secret and all of that stuff. So because of that, I got to be more aware than the rest of my siblings. So, but of course, the other thing as well is like the health systems were different, so to speak. In Nigeria, at that time, the way cancer was dealt with, as in the oncology follow-up and everything, was abysmal, to say the least. Because my mom's, when it went into her bones, it was dismissed and missed by a consultant because it didn't do due diligence. But with my sister, at least she had all the treatment that she could have, you know. So that was obvious. They were big differences.
I mean, that must have been so difficult for you, seeing that firsthand as a teenager, and then almost having to go through that same thing again when your sister was diagnosed. You had the decision to have a preventative mastectomy, is that right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
So how did you come to that decision? Was it just, was it difficult to reach that point? Was there a lot of back and forth between that?
Sorry.
Silly question, right? It's got to be difficult.
Sorry, I'm laughing because it was a journey and a half, let me just say. Because when my sister was, by the time my sister was diagnosed in 2011, I'd already had fibroadenoma removed from both my breasts. So the first time was in 2000. The second time was in 2005 after I had my daughter. So I was no stranger to breast surgeries, at least in terms of removing lumps. But as far as I was concerned, I was very vigilant and all of that stuff. When my sister was diagnosed and I told my GP, because I went to, ironically, I went to him for something different because I was having bad headaches and everything. And I wanted him to give me stronger painkillers. And then he went, oh, you are stressed. So first things first, to be signed off for stress as a strong Black woman that I am, it was such a strange experience. And then my GP said, well, I think you need to consider the bilateral mastectomy with immediate reconstruction. First things first, I looked at him like, typical man. What does he know about losing losing breasts? Typical man. And plus, I had a very good pair, honestly. I had an abundance what people were paying plastic surgeons for. So needless to say, I told him, I said, listen, I'm checking myself. There's no lump, there's nothing and all of that stuff. And the irony is that this man kept on my case for 2 years. But in those 2 years, I wasn't idle or anything like that. I started reading up about stuff. He referred me to cancer genetics. And through cancer genetics, I now got my first mammogram in 2011. And then they did a mammogram and they wrote back to me and said, oh, we don't like what we're seeing. Come back. So you can imagine the worry of that and everything like that. So I went back and they said it was calcification, breast calcifications, which is something funny. That's what they first saw. That's what they thought. They operated. But one of the surgeons did a hatchet job on my breast, so to speak, because it was just messy. Oh,
goodness.
But at least the third one did a good job and he told me it's cleared it all. I had a mammogram which came back very, very clear. But my GP was still carrying on. And I'm thinking, what's this old man talking about? look at the results, look at everything. But then in early 2013, I now felt a lump in another breast again. And I'm thinking, okay, you know what? This is it. I had to sit with myself and ask myself the question, why was I running away from this surgery? You know, because I'm a person of faith. If it was a matter of deep conviction and faith that I shouldn't do it, that's a different thing. But it was vanity, full stop. It was because I loved my boobs and they were beautiful, you know, so that was it. But then I realized that, you know what, I couldn't push the decision. I couldn't avoid it anymore. So I told my GP, he couldn't write the referral fast enough. he was like, finally, she's listening to me and everything like that. And so, of course, fast forward to 2014, I now had the prophylactic mastectomy with immediate reconstruction using Dieppe flap. So that means using tissue from my belly. Because I remember when I first went to the first consultation I went to with a breast surgeon that I saw after my GP referred me, and I'd been reading up about this thing now for 2 years, you know, if you know anything about me, is that I love researching. I love knowing things. I love having my facts as much as possible, because I'm not one of those people who will go to a GP and not grill them. So all my doctors know, I grill them a lot. So he was now like, oh, well, because they're going to do two, that because you could use tissue from your back or whatever like that, or your belly and all of that. So, and he was, at the time, he was looking at me, I was like, you don't really have anything on your belly for them to use. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. And then he also gave the option of implants. But here's the thing. At the time, I was 37. And I thought to myself, if I had an implant at 37, and I called BAPRAS to confirm it. So BAPRAS is the British Association of Plastic Reconstruction Aesthetic Surgeons.
You really did do your research.
Yeah. So I called them to ask them what the lifespan of a breast implant will be. And they said nothing more than 15 years. So 37 plus 15, that will be 52. That means I would have to repeat the surgery again. And I thought, nah, not happening. So I went and started binging on cakes and everything like that to get the flesh on my belly. So that was what I did. No, seriously. So I ate a lot and everything like that. So by the time I saw my plastic surgeon, I was like, well, we've got lots of flesh to use. Mm-hmm. So that was what he did. But my plastic surgeon was just amazing because he recognized that I was one of those patients who will ask questions. So it was the one who gave me a leaflet, told me to call the papyrus, told me to Google him because I was asking him how long he'd been doing it for, how many complications he had. And he was like, no, I'm not using you for target practice, I promise you. So the tissues were sent for testing as a matter of course. So you can imagine when I got a call from the breast clinic to come for my results, I'm like, give it to me over the phone because I thought it was a formality.
Yeah.
They're like, no, we cannot give it to you over the phone. You have to come in person. So in my head, I was still thinking precancer cells because when they gave me the results for the precancer cells, they didn't give it over the phone. I had to go into clinic to get that. At the time, I was still recovering from the major surgery I had because the reconstruction that I had took 12 and a half hours.
Wow.
So, and I was in hospital for 8 days. So literally, I was still like, I still had dressings and all of that stuff and everything.
Yeah.
So it was a friend who came to pick me up. And literally, we didn't take it seriously. We even went to lunch. And then from lunch, we went to the hotel like that. So when I was called in and she asked if she could come, I'm like, sure, it's a formality. Come and sit in.
Yeah.
what a shock. So I got there. Sat down, my friend, the surgeon, my breast surgeon, and my breast care nurse. And then like when someone is trying to tell you something and they're trying to think of the best way to do it. So she said with my right breast, they had fibroadenoma, which was fine, and that's whatever. And then on the left one, she was like, they found invasive DCIS grade 2.
This is a post-recording note. DCIS and invasive breast cancer are different types of breast cancer, but may be diagnosed at the same time. You can find more information about each of these on the Breast Cancer Now website.
It felt like a car had run me over.
Hmm.
You know, like when you have such a shock and your ears are buzzing and you're thinking, for real? Because as far as I was concerned, I'd just gone through a 12 and a half hour surgery with bandages and all of those things and everything like that to prevent this from happening.
Mm.
So all the other three women were looking at me now because they were like, what's she going to do? What's she going to do? And everything like that. But then I thought about it. I'm like, sink or swim. I've got a choice.
Mm.
And I sat there and I thought, no, sinking is not an option. I'm a mother. I've got my life ahead of me. And I made a decision at that time. Because this was something that was going on in my head, because it took me a few minutes to respond. So I was having the internal dialogue with myself.
Mm.
And I made a decision that I will not let cancer crush me. I will not let cancer define me. That rather I will be a victor, not a victim. And you know what? That decision that I made before I even opened up my mouth, it carved everything that happened after from that time even till now, because I'm still on medication at the moment and I've got side effects and everything like that. So when I now spoke up, believe it or not, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, I'm like, listen, I've gone through a 12 and a half hour surgery to get these two beauties. I hope you're not going to tamper with them. Oh my God.
Priorities straight in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They just bust out laughing and everything like that. But the thing is, like, that laughter, that humor, it eased the tension in the room straight up, because everybody was wondering what I was going to do. And then I thought, hold on, you know what? It happened. Now let's deal with this. But my mindset matters. So we went to the next room and the radiologist was waiting for us. And the man was looking like he was looking very sad. A part of me wanted to tell him that, look, it's not that bad. Come on, cheer up.
Mm.
But of course, he was doing his job. So that kind of thing. You know? Long story short, I had to have some, because the biopsy that they took from the lymph nodes was not substantial enough. So I had to go through surgery to remove some of the lymph nodes. And of course, the gift that brought now is lymphedema in my left hand.
Right, yeah.
Since then, because I made a decision not to have chemotherapy. Now, I know that that's a controversial decision, right? But for me, that was the decision I felt I wanted to make. That was the decision. I just had this conviction that that was the one that was best for me. And more so, the cancer hadn't spread.
Right.
So, but my breast surgeon, she was not amused. She was not happy. She's a lovely woman. She was like, but you're young, blah, blah, blah. This is, I said, as long as it hasn't spread, I said, you go back to your multidisciplinary team meetings and find another solution for me. I said, I'm prepared to go through radiotherapy, but chemotherapy, let's take that off the table. Because I felt it would weaken my immunity. And I didn't know how I would react to it. And I didn't know what problems it would bring alongside. I took chemo off the table. But surgically, I went for more radical options when it came to surgery. Because after tamoxifen didn't agree with me, so after a year, I was put on letrozole. And because I was premenopausal, I had to have Zoladex, so injections in the belly at the same time. I started speaking to my old GP. This was my previous GP now. The man is retired, you know. And I was asking him questions because after a year and 3 months of using the letrozole and Zoladex, I had a meeting with the oncologist. And because my breast cancer is estrogen fed, so it's estrogen receptor, so it's fully estrogen fed. So, and I, at the time I was 38, 39, and the oncologist was like, look, you're still young and everything like that, but we need to try and limit the supply of estrogen so that we don't have to think about recurrence. Mm-hmm. So he now said my ovaries need to be removed because that's the biggest supply of estrogen and everything. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But then I went to my GP. I said, okay, listen, once they start going in there, what do you think about doing the rest of the plumbing? Because the thing was, in terms of my family history and the tamoxifen that I used, that didn't agree with me at all and everything like that, I was at a higher risk of endometrial and those ovarian cancers, so to speak.
Right, yeah.
And as far as I was concerned, if they're going to go in there, like I said, you might as well finish the plumbing so that we don't have to come back to it again.
Yeah.
So my GP was like, that was actually an excellent idea. But then when I got to the gynecologist, it was a fight because the gynecologist was like, oh, but you're young, blah, blah. I'm like, listen, I've had breast cancer.
Yeah.
My sister's had it. My mom's had it. I have a child. I had my daughter was 11 at the time. I said, I'm grateful that I even have one child. I said, so of what use will be a womb to me if the cancer goes there or whatever like that? So it was like, you hooed and had and everything. I'm like, listen, I will get what I want. Long story short, on the day of the surgery, he now agreed. So they did the proper plumbing properly. So all of the stuff, the ovaries, the womb and the cervix, phew, taken out. And because this was now in 2016, so 2 years after diagnosis, that gave me such peace of mind. Because for me, I felt like I'd done everything that I could do to cut the risk. Now, here's the thing. Some people might look at the decision I've made, because on the one hand, you have chemotherapy. Some people might think that chemotherapy was an easier choice than a full hysterectomy. But this is one of those things that it is your journey.
Yeah.
Every person is different, you know. And ironically, when I was speaking to the oncologist, he was like a year after whatever, like there was like, in actual fact, he wasn't sure whether chemotherapy would have been of net benefit to me.
Mm.
And a paper came out later on that year as well from Lancet stating that not all early breast cancer diagnosis require chemotherapy.
Yeah, so that's throughout this time, you'd clearly done your research, you went in there, you you were an advocate for yourself so strongly. And I guess that was partly informed by you had had an experience of breast cancer before. You'd lived it secondhand.
Yeah.
So you already knew how it might affect you, what you wanted to get out of this from treatment. You did your research, and it sounds like you really understood what you were talking about, and you cared what you were talking about. Yeah. And now you are using that experience to kind of educate others through Breast Cancer Now. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what first brought you to the charity.
It was 2013, before I had my reconstruction. In Morriston Hospital, on a yearly basis, they started doing this program, which was Breast Reconstruction Awareness. So they will bring together women who've had reconstruction, women who were waiting, and then all of the surgeons and the nurses, so that they can speak to people and get women to know what it is that they were going to be expecting. But then outside the room, you have a couple of charities. I only vaguely knew about Breast Cancer Now through their leaflets. I told her about the fact that I would like to speak to younger women and women from ethnic minority backgrounds so that they check themselves properly and all of that stuff, so that they are diagnosed earlier. So she now said, oh, you're the kind of person we want. You should join the charity. So within about 6 months of my diagnosis, when I felt well enough or whatever like that, I then applied to become somebody who gives breast health talks, breast cancer awareness talks, you know. So that was in 2015, and I've been there since then. So in the focus for me, when I go to, because I've done talks in the community, and I've done it in companies, I've done it in organizations, I've done it in communities. And I normally have a couple of things I focus on. Number one, younger women. Because a lot of younger women who think it cannot happen to them, they're too young, blah, blah, blah. And I told the women, I said, you know what? You need to start falling in love with your breast. Because whatever you love, you will tend to, you will take care of it, you will pay attention to, so that when something is wrong, then you will be able to spot it. And when something goes amiss, you know the signs to spot. So that's one group I always speak about. And then people from ethnic minority backgrounds, because a lot of times there are we don't talk often about this. Things are slowly changing because there are now a few advocates who are beginning to speak up. But we've still got a long way to go, because the whole thing about the stigma, the silence, the secrecy, the shame that surrounds cancer, it's similar to what surrounds things like mental health and all of that stuff and everything. And because when people are secrecy and silence, they're deadly. I know firsthand the damage that secrecy and stigma and silence and shame around health does, and especially around breast cancers, you know. So I speak on things like that, and I highlight that, especially during Breast Cancer Awareness Month and all of that stuff and everything. There's a lot more work that needs to be done to target younger women. And I'm talking maybe between the ages of 20 and 40, you know, especially in terms of messaging on social media. So I don't understand TikTok at all. I don't.
Neither do I. It's okay.
It's for my daughter's generation or whatever like that. But the thing is, like, I believe that in order to engage an audience, you have to speak their language. So that's one of the things I believe that Breast Cancer Now, generally all cancer charities, but Breast Cancer Now need to do a bit more work on. Because especially in this day and age of appearances and how you look and all of that stuff and everything like that, getting young women to know their breasts from a young age and be checking and know what's amiss. You know, so yes, we know that for younger women, the percentage is small, but all it takes is for someone in your family or a friend to be diagnosed. And then you know that statistics and behind statistics, there are people. I was 37 when I was diagnosed. So I was, by all accounts, a younger woman. My sister was 40, so she was young as well.
And I think what you're saying is of course very important, that you want to speak to younger women, you want to speak to ethnic minorities. And I think it's where those two categories converge, younger women of color especially. And you actually described yourself earlier as a strong Black woman, which I think is completely correct. But do you think that perception of younger women or young Black women thinking that they have to be strong Black women, do you think that might cause some resistance in getting checked? They might, or is it just the perception of them from doctors and from the medical side of things, that there's just too much of a stereotype that already exists there, that it's harder to break through?
It goes both ways. I will gladly say that it goes both ways. So first you have, so someone like myself now, if I go to a GP now, whatever like that, unless I tell you my age, you will not know that I'm middle-aged, because I don't look it. People have told me I look 10 years younger and everything like that. When younger women from ethnic minority backgrounds, when they go to GPs, a lot of the times, because they're not breaking down completely and sobbing and all of that stuff, because that's not necessarily their way. Because for me, I wouldn't go to a GP and be falling apart or whatever like that. For me, I'll be going to a GP with my strong persona. Because number one, that strong persona is self-protective too. But then, you then have GPs who have the stereotypes, who have their unconscious biases about women from ethnic minority backgrounds as, oh, well, they're not crying, they're not this, they're not that. So that means they're not in pain. That means there's whatever and all of that stuff. Culture runs deep. Cultural norms, they run deep. And it takes a very long time to dismantle them. And people like myself, we're rebels because we're going against the grain. But initially, when and the thing is, like, as a rebel, you have to develop a thick skin because you have all of the older generation who give advice on what we should be doing and how things are, the way things are. The guardians of the culture, so to speak. It's the conditioning. It's how deep-rooted that is, that, oh, you're strong, that there is nothing new under the sun. There's nothing that's happened to you that hasn't happened to somebody else. You know, so with things like that running through women's heads sometimes, it can be so difficult for them to even broach the idea because they want to be getting on with their lives. That's why the education has to go both ways, in the community, but also with GPs, because GPs are the first port of call. Too many cancers have been missed. I'm not even talking about just breasts. Too many cancers are being missed because a lot of doctors will see a young woman and say, oh, you're too young for it. For me, as far as I'm concerned, if a woman reports a sign that should be checked, if you get that woman to be checked at that time and they have an ultrasound scan, compared to someone like my sister who was diagnosed at stage 3, aggressive stage.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, my sister had a treatment privately, but if she was in the NHS, the amount of money it would cost the NHS compared to the treatment of the person who's caught early, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, you're completely right. I agree with everything you said there. I also think that in the work that you do, you are such a fantastic role model because you embody the strong Black woman, but also the advocate. And you are teaching other women to love both sides of themselves in that way, to say, yes, you know, you are allowed to love your body and take care of it, but also advocate for it. And I think that has been so important in everything you've said. That's really shone through, is you being proactive and actually looking for solutions and investigating things that you thought were wrong or could go wrong. And I think that's fantastic that you're out there talking to people about this. But for people that can't go along to these talks or haven't had the opportunity yet, or are not just in the kind of environment where they would normally access that, how do you think we can encourage those people to be more vigilant, to check themselves? What sorts of conversations should we be having? How can we talk about this with people?
Okay. Well, the thing is, like, when you start to, especially with something that, like breasts, that is so personal and so intimate, people need to be able to relate to who is speaking to them. Because, and this is where representation matters all across board. People need to be, because that's why I do what, that's one of the reasons why I do what I do. Because I not only volunteer with Breast Cancer Now, I also lecture at Cardiff University. Mm-hmm. Where I speak to oncology nurses, there's this module called Understanding Cancer Care. So I share my experiences as a patient teaching partner, but I also share my experiences with other courses or whatever. So nurses, that kind of thing. And the thing is like representation matters, because when you're talking about intimate things or whatever like that, number one, go to where these people are. Whether it's a mix of a fundraising event come awareness event. So it's a two-pronged thing. You get money for the charity, but you also speak to people. But make sure that the people who go to speak to them, they're people they can relate to. No offense. If you were to go to, say, like a Bangladeshi Muslim community, for example, I'm just using this as an example, so I'm not generalizing, but if you were to go there and tell them that, oh, I understand what it's like to be scared of checking your breast, it's like, for real? You don't.
Yeah, no, of course. It's like you said, the culture runs deep. It's
yeah,
different perceptions amongst different cultural groups. So, yeah.
Yes. It's one thing to have leaflets with people from diverse ethnic communities on the cover and all of that stuff. If it doesn't go beyond that, that's tokenism. Mm. And in actual fact, tokenism does more harm than good in the long run. Because when you do make tokenistic gestures, then you don't address the underlying issues. And it masks what is going on. So getting out into the community, speaking the language of the people, getting people who they can relate to. So because, for example, now, if I go to an Asian community, for example, right? To some extent, I can relate to a lot of things. I will still have to be very careful about certain things. Mm. I will still have to be careful not to make assumptions. Yeah? And I say this all the time in every speech or every talk or lecture I give. I say every single person wants to be heard and understood. As long as you think you have that at the back of your mind, everybody, it doesn't matter whether they're the prime minister or whether they're a cleaner on the street, everybody wants to be heard, everybody wants to be understood. Mm. So the place of being heard, when for people to feel that they're heard, they want to feel that you can relate to them. I'll say this without apologies or whatever, even though I'm a volunteer. For example, when you look at videos that Breast Cancer Now does, a lot of the time it's a white woman who's there. Mm. So, you know, mixing that up again as well and everything like that, because a black woman who's in her 60s, for example, right, who's just been diagnosed with cancer or something like that, if a white woman in her 50s was talking to her about certain things, she'd be like, for real? You don't even get it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
No, I completely hear you. And it's sometimes a subject that people might not want to address and might feel uncomfortable talking about, especially as like you say, I'm a white person. I have to acknowledge that there are some things that I can't talk about. Mm. But what it sounds like from what you're saying is there is an importance of kind of speaking with within our own communities, but also where we have the opportunity to kind of lift up other communities and lift up the voices of ethnic minorities who might otherwise not get that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's, like I said, there's more work that needs to be done because who are the people who are answering the questions? I'm coming back to the whole thing about representation, and I'm not using it as a blanket statement. I'm not saying that white people cannot speak to black people. That's not what I'm saying. Mm. What I'm saying is, like, if you're going to organize a community event, make sure that there's a mix. Say you have a panel and you're speaking to ethnic minorities or whatever like that, and they're all white, and you're trying to talk to them about lived experience. Come on. That's not it at all. So it's about working together, because there aren't enough ethnic minority patient advocates at the moment for the scale of the issue. So we have to work together. There's the need for mutual respect. So let's say you have a patient advocate who's coming or whatever like that. There needs to be that element of, yes, you're coming with your expertise. Whether your expertise is purely your experience, it's still expertise, and that should be valued alongside people who come from the medical point of view, for example, and all of that stuff, you know. So that's what I think.
Yeah, and again, I agree with you there. And just just for breast cancer now, I agree with your points that there is often not enough representation, and that is something that's constantly being worked on. But we'll also try and have services like Someone Like Me. We'll try and make sure that there is someone who can emote with you, not just on the, you know, the medical knowledge, but also that lived experience, like you say. So there's constantly ways that we're trying to cross these bridges.
Yeah.
But there's still so much progress that needs to be done. And you're absolutely right. And I think that you are taking on a huge task in doing that. And that I'm so pleased that you, I feel like I've already said that, but I'm so pleased you are doing it, because I can see from how you talk about it and from how breast cancer has affected you that this is just something that's not acknowledged enough and it's not spoken about enough. And you've doubtless changed so many people's lives and helped so many people through what you've done. Sorry, this is quite a big topic, I know, that we're talking about. Do you feel like that we've covered those questions in enough depth? Is there anything else that you wanted to add there?
Well, the thing is, like, basically in terms of what I do, because I'm more than just a volunteer, right? And the thing is, like, because of the way that breast cancer has affected my life, it's not just something I say, it's at the heart of what I do. So for my business, it's Inspired to Soar. And basically, I help people who've been impacted by cancer to thrive, not just survive. Because that's one other thing that I'm passionate about the fact that there's more to life after cancer than just merely existing. Because I think fundamentally, because when you go down to the very roots of why people are not presenting in clinic early enough and all of, underline all of that, it's fear. The fear of dying, the fear of not being there for their children or their loved ones, the fear of them not being able to do anything or whatever like that. So, and all of those things are very real fears. But my message to people and the people I coach and everything like that is that there's more to life after cancer than merely existing. You can thrive, you can find fulfillment, you can pursue your most audacious goals. Yes, it's a journey. It is a journey. So even when you've lost a loved one to cancer, to breast cancer, let me tell you, as somebody who's walked that path as well, there's hope for you. There is not just hope, not just wishy-washy hope. There's strong hope for you. On the other side of your grief, there is a whole world. There is, you know what, there's so much more to you than meets the eye. There's so much more that you can achieve. And that's the thing. You can thrive, but don't settle for survival. Don't. Yes, it is used in the cancer, it's a predominant narrative in terms of how you survive after whatever like that. And the word is useful. It's very, very useful in terms of people who are staying alive. That's fine. But as an individual, once you've moved past the I'm alive stage, there is more to life than just existing.
Could just listen to you talk all day.
Thank you.
Genuinely, you've been so fantastic to talk with, because you are breaching topics that some people might want to swerve around, but they're important, and you've given them that time, and I'm so glad you have. I'm so glad that we're able to share this as well. And I hope people listen to this and, you know, it might open people's eyes a bit more.
Yeah, that will encourage them, because my aim is that it will reach across divides, not just racially, but also age-wise, you know, that it will reach across divides, that people will know that breast cancer now is for everybody who's impacted by breast cancer, not just the young, not just the middle-aged people who make up the 80% demographic kind of thing. But for anyone who's been touched by breast cancer, that this is for you and everything like that. And for me, with regards to the work I do, I want to make sure that people know that they can thrive. People can follow me on LinkedIn, on Twitter at InspiredToSew2, and they can go to my website as well. Know that you have support, you know. And then if you guys will put the telephone number, Breast Cancer Now telephone number, so that they know who to call. Because that number becomes a lifeline when their world falls apart, right?
Completely right. Thank you. You've stolen my job there at the end of signing off. But like you say, people can find you on social media. We'll link it in the show notes so that people can find you. I believe Bami has a podcast of her own coming out at the end of this year. And
we'll
update with details about that when that happens. Genuinely, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This has been fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for the privilege. I continue to be part of the Breast Cancer Now family.
Yeah, and we're really pleased to have you.
6 years going, I'm still not bored yet.
Good. good. Keep that energy up. Bami raised some really important points here, and we recognise that we still have work to do. Equality, diversity and inclusion is a priority area of work for us, and something we're committed to developing in everything we do. We know a great deal still needs to be done to address inequalities for people affected by breast cancer, and we need to do this to achieve our vision that by 2050, all those diagnosed with breast cancer will live and be supported to live well. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Make sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred podcast service to hear our next episode. If you have any questions or concerns from listening today, you can find information on our research, services and campaigning on our website at breastcancernow.org.